Thank you for being here this afternoon. As Arnold said, my name is Andy Baker-White, and I'm the Associate Director of the Mid-States Region of the Network for Public Health Law. So just briefly, the Network for Public Health Law, we are a five-office organization across the country. We have five offices across the country, and what we do is we provide technical legal support for anyone who has questions on how law can be used to improve or promote or protect public health. We also provide trainings for attorneys or public health practitioners, webinars, and different resources on the use of law. Our current funder right now is Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. We have a sister organization, the Public Health Law Research Program out of Temple University, and they actually look at the research, or they actually look at, you know, is this law doing for public health what it was meant to do, or are there harms? So, you know, together we provide both the research and the practice when it comes to public health law. I'm also the a governing council member, APHA governing council member of the law section, and Arnold and the Vietnam Caucus, you know, reached out to our section to see if we could participate in the session, and so it's another reason why I'm here today to try to help out Arnold and the Vietnam War Caucus. So it's a pleasure and an honor to be here, and I hope to talk. I plan to talk a little bit about, you know, the relationship between law and war, and even look at more recently since 9/11. Some of the ways that public health and war, public health law and war, or the military have become a little more intertwined, and even you know, unfortunately the recent Ebola outbreak has shown the role that the military actually plays when it comes to public health. So I'll also talk a little bit about that. So again, just a quick disclosure, I have no personal financial relationships with commercial interests relevant to this presentation. So no relationships to disclose. And hopefully at the end of my presentation, everyone here will be able to discuss a little bit about what that relationship is between law and war, and describe how public health law surrounding emergencies now actually encompasses some sort of a military role. So first, let's jump right in. The relationship, this relationship between law and war. When we think about it, when we look at this relationship between law and war, if war, it really comes down, it really boils down to that one can be used to justify and assert the other. Law can be used to set up what a person's, not just like in the war field or, you know, the military field, but law sets up, you know, our property rights, our, you know, national interests. You know, you think about trade agreements; those are, you know, legal agreements between countries as far as trade. Our national security; those are the things that law can be used to kind of establish. And violence and war, or the enforcement mechanisms of the state, are used to protect those interests that law has created. And on the flip side, using war to prop those up actually can be used to legitimize the law itself. So again, you know, law a lot of times can be used to actually make war and to justify the use of force and violence, not just on a wider scale, but you know, for example, if you think about your property rights, if your house is robbed, you call the police. So the law is establishing your property rights, and the enforcement mechanism of the state is used to protect those rights. So in a lot of ways, the assertion of violence is justified by the law. So the law gives you a right to own something, to do something in the state through either the police or the military uses that aspect to protect that right or to enforce that right. So how did this relationship, another interesting thing that, you know, when I started looking at this was, so how did this relationship come about? Where did law and war, how did they become connected? And the one thing I was able to kind of really see was, because if we think about it, you know, if you think about history, we always think about how there were periods of war, periods of peace, then a period of war, then a period of peace, how they're very delineated. And we look now, and I don't really see a period of peace versus a period of war. It's all very, very, very interconnected with the way the military acts and you know, how we protect our interests and, you know, where does peace begin, where does war end? It's not clear anymore. And I think if we look back in the history, that's not where a lot of people hoped we would end up. So when we look back to that time of where there were periods of war, periods of peace, there was this that's you know, kind of really the time of real politic. So might makes right, basically. And then we go from that to, you know, trying to use international law as a way to regulate war and to manage peace. So we're going to manage peace through the law. If you think about World War I, that was the war to end all wars. That was the attempt at the League of Nations. So there was this push to move war and peace away from the barbaric kings who were the ones who were able to make war and put that structure in the law where it can be more regulated. So it was hoped for at one point that law would be used as a tool to regulate military conflict. Just like, we hope that law can be used as a tool for public health. At that point, there was a hope that law could be used as a tool to regulate military conflict. So managing peace requires procedures, practices, frameworks, and those were being set up through the law. But what happened was that law can also be used as a tool to generate military conflict. What started was, you know, law was being used to buy and sell weapons, to recruit soldiers. You know, what laws were developed for the recruiting purposes, for the managing of the armed services, for encouraging innovative technology, for organizing support for the conflicts, for disciplining troops, and just, you know, the logistical framework, you know, for making an army or a military work. You know, those were all put into certain legal frameworks, and that's where, you know, law. So law now not only is being able or is being used to manage the peace, but it's also being used to manage the wars. So it soon became not just a tool. Law became not just a tool of peace, but a tool of war. So what we had out of that is the military action became a legal action. So in certain ways that and so legal acts have now become sort of military weapons. You know, the military buying satellite capacity and imaging and the images from satellites to keep it from another person. Using law to seize the other side's assets some way. All of those things could be conducted through other means. I mean, you know, we could destroy those assets in some way, or we could use the law to seize those assets. So actually, you know, the law has, in a lot of ways, become an actual tool of the military and just one other weapon in the arsenal. So again, they've become a strategic partner. You know, law is now a strategic partner for the military, just as it had been for humanitarians earlier in the 20th century who wanted to use law to ensure peace. So that again, you know, when you get into the legal world, that opens words up to interpretation. And so I think, you know, that's when we look back to the Iraq War, a lot of the opponents to it, you know, mention it as an illegal war. You know, so we've moved away from the real politic of, you know, being a just war to now is it, you know, just or unjust conflict to now is it a legal or an illegal conflict. So, you know, kind of just my thoughts on it is that, you know, the law has in some way tempered our reaction to it. I mean, you know, just and unjust, that's something that we can, you know, that really hits at our mind and our heart. Well, legal, illegal, you know, that kind of, let's interpret that. You know, okay, this lawyer says that. You know, that's the words. They can say, they're the same words, but they can have different meanings. And also, you know, using the law in the military has allowed other types of law to kind of seep into the military. So again, that kind of goes back to the last slide, where we have, you know, private law. You know, the law between soldiers has now seeped into it. Contract law is really now involved. You know, used by the military to purchasing and selling weapons. Employment law. Protections for soldiers to, you know, who are deployed, you know, ensuring that they have their jobs and employment when they return from their deployment, and even some environmental regulations. You know, the military is, you know, finds themselves you know, having to do environmental impact assessments when they want to do I think it was up in the Northwest when they were wanting to look at using sonar, you know, in certain ways, and you know, and then people, you know, no, you have to do an environmental impact assessment. What effect would that have on the whales in Puget Sound? So the military is now kind of having to deal with these other types of laws. But it, also in another way, getting law and war interconnected I saw this argument one place that maybe has allowed the violence to seep into other areas of the law. So, for example, you know, if you look at our legal framework that we have here in the U.S., it permits violence and death, you know, outside of military conflict. You have the coal mine industry where workers die, you know, because regulations aren't followed. You have cancer clusters, you know, because companies, you know, are allowed to avoid the regulations to protect the public health. So laws, you know, and because of these harms, laws are then put in place to address these harms. So we allow certain types of injuries in industry, but we allow those harms to be compensated if someone has violated a duty of care. So you know, this violence has seeped out into other areas of the law, but then the law also is trying to ensure that the harms are compensated. And other ways that laws are used to try to avoid these harms are, you know, through zoning regulations and allowing people to sue or negotiate compensation for their harm. So that's kind of how I've, you know, in looking at this, seen where that relationship is. Really, you know, going back that one allows the other, one props up the other, and we're kind of getting to where, you know, simply law is a tool that allows military conflicts and has allowed violence to seep into other areas of our life. So as far as, you know, public health emergencies, you know, what role is the military now playing in our response to public health emergencies? So since 9/11, or after 9/11, there was this great concern with bioterrorism. Bioterrorism was seen as a national security threat, and very quickly, other national disasters or potential national disasters or epidemics were kind of folded into that national security concern. So now all of a sudden, SARS can be a national security concern. Ebola can be seen as a national security concern, not just a public health concern, but something that broader action needs to be taken on. So pandemic disease, again, seen as a national security concern. So even if you look at the establishment of the Department of Homeland Security, one would probably think, oh, to respond to terrorism or to bioterrorism. But actually, the role of the DHS, when you look at it, is not only for terrorist attacks, but also for natural disasters or any other large-scale emergency. Again, the issue of isolation and quarantine, one of those we've been hearing a lot here recently about, what is isolation and quarantine, who has the authority, and so forth. So the isolation and quarantine from communicable disease. So there was some change in the law to allow isolation and quarantine from a communicable stage, so when a person can actually pass on the disease, to a pre-communicable stage. So we're seeing how the law is being more and more restrictive in epidemics or pandemic settings. And then finally, one of the more interesting things that I found out was how in 2006, at that point was known as the Insurrection Act. It's a federal law. That allows military enforcement of isolation and quarantine. In 2006, that law was renamed, and it first allowed military enforcement at the federal government's instruction without consulting the states in times of a terrorist attack or internal insurrection. In 2006, the law was amended to allow that type of response for epidemics. And there was actually a backlash on that. And in 2007, it was actually repealed and put back to where the federal government can only use the military to respond to those types of internal insurrection or outside threats rather than because of epidemics. And then, as I said, unfortunately, the Ebola outbreak has brought some of these issues to the forefront, as we stand here today. Something really caught my mind. I was looking at the news last month. The fact that the military actually put together military response teams for Ebola. The U.S. military Ebola rapid response teams, which were made up of 30 members, and they were meant to be used to supervise the treatment and help hospitals deal with when there are infections. So, the idea that, this is the role for the military in this response, when it's usually the states are the ones who are given the charge with protecting the public health, but now we have the federal government and the military being the ones who could possibly take the lead. These were actually created and established before the doctor in New York City was put in isolation quarantine, but it wasn't used at that time. And the news article that I read said that because the hospital didn't request it. But just showing again how the military and how public health emergency response is, in some ways being militarized. And again, we see, you know, with the Ebola response, the sending of troops to West Africa for the humanitarian efforts to actually build the hospitals and provide that sort of support there. And then something that I kind of noticed was with the New York employment protections. Everyone remembers the nurse in New Jersey who then went to Maine, and now I think she's left Maine. After when that was happening, there was an announcement by the state of New York and the city of New York in New York City that they were adopting a policy that would allow health workers who were coming back from West Africa that their employment would be protected. So if you work here in the States and you volunteer to go over to South Africa, your employment will be saved. So to prevent people from going there, helping, and then coming back, being put into isolation for 21 days and having their employer say, you know, you're fired. And that kind of goes, you know, into some of these ancillary services that we have and that we need for isolation and quarantine. The template for this new policy is for what we do with our military, with our troops who might be deployed, but we're going to save their employment for them for when they return. So I thought that was a little interesting in how, you know, this the law that's been used for the military has kind of seeped back into public health to actually help public health in some ways. So that's really all I have. So just real short, the resources I was able to use for, you know, to put this together, Kennedy's of war and law, and then Surratt, Douglas, and Humphrey's Law and War. So if anyone's interested in kind of having a little bit more detail as far as, you know, Law and War, it goes up there. And so thank you. Here's my contact information if anyone's on Twitter.
Are there any comments, questions, disagreements? Do you think law has anything to do with war, or war has anything to do with law? Please.
Moving back to that real politic realm, rather than, you know, has it been a failed experiment to actually use law to regulate war, you know?
And the United States is a culprit too.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah, and it's really, you know, looking at it, you know, I was thinking about, you know, back in the early 20th century when the idea of using law, you think about Roosevelt and the Four Freedoms, you know, oh, you know, let's come up with the Four Freedoms for, you know, worship and from want and so forth, and use, you know, trying to use law to protect those. But at the same time, that law can be used to violate other people's freedoms at the same time. So I think, yeah, I mean, there's a tension there, but, like, you know, I think on a whole, law can be used to justify war, and war can be used to legitimize the law. Anyone else?
Thank you.
think you've addressed it. Are you thinking, I remember seeing some, there was some action in, is it Wisconsin? I think there was one story where the hikers were out hiking and all of a sudden there was a person in full camouflage with the rifle, and yeah, because they were there to secure the spot for the owners of the industrial owners of the land.
Correct.
Yeah.
That's happening more and more, although
yeah.
I disagree that people have the right. So
anyone can hear you except
oh.
In front of you. Can you stand up?
Oh, sorry. And the argument for them is they're protecting their property rights. Yeah, so they're using the enforcement arm, and they're being allowed to hire private security to enforce their and protect their property.